Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
First of all, I would always like to welcome everybody to the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and thank you for coming out this evening and supporting local and independent businesses in your community. That really does make a difference. I'll be brief because tonight's author is so exceptional. For you, those of you who don't know much about the new book, the seventh book, seventh novel, Someone, which has just recently come out, is garnering so much great praise and so well deserved. Without further ado, please help me in welcoming Alice McDermott.
Thank you so much. Thank you, and thank you for being here, and thank you for this wonderful bookstore. Tattered Cover is just a gorgeous place. We all need to support these independents, and clearly by your presence here, you're showing that you do, and I am most grateful as someone whose livelihood depends very much on readers and places where readers gather. Thank you so much for being here at this great store. I don't want to spend a lot of time filling you in on the story. This is a simple enough, on one level, novel that's pretty much just tells the story of a woman's life. Everywhere I go, I'm hearing that I'm telling the story of an ordinary woman's life. But I had a reader the other day object to that, and she said to me, I think they should say a recognizable woman's life. None of us, after all, is ordinary. So to dispense with too much background, I'm just going to read a little bit from the opening two chapters. The only thing that that I might point out is almost against the whole ordinary theme. It seems to me, now that I have some distance from my own work, that it's in these two bits that I'm about to read that the crux of the novel and of this woman's life, and maybe even what I was attempting to do in bringing her to life, is set forth. So this is the first chapter. Hagin Shahab walked up from the subway in the evening light. Her good spring coat was powder blue. Her shoes were black and covered the insteps of her long feet. Her hat was beige with something dark along the crown, a brown feather or two. There was a certain asymmetry to her shoulders. She had a loping, hunchbacked walk. She had always a bit of black hair along her cheek straggling to her shoulder, her bun coming undone. She carried her purse in the lightest clasp of her fingers down along the side of her leg, which made her seem listless and weary, even as she covered the distance quickly enough, the gray sidewalk from subway to parlor floor and basement of the house next door. I was on the stoop of my own house, waiting for my father. Pegin paused to say hello. She was not a pretty girl particularly. There was a narrowness to her eyes and a wideness to her jaw, crooked teeth, wild eyebrows, and a faint mustache. She had her Syrian father's thick, dark hair, but also the permanent scattered flush just under the fair skin of her Irish mother's broad cheeks. She had a job in Lower Manhattan in this, her first year out of manual training, and she said she didn't like the people there. She didn't like a single one of them. She ran a bare hand along the stone balustrade above my head. The other, which lightly held the strap of her purse, wore a dove gray glove. She had lost its partner somewhere, she said, and laughed with her crooked teeth. Fourth pair this month, she said, and left the library book she was reading on the subway yesterday. And look, tore her stocking on something. She lifted her black shoe to the step where I sat and pulled back the long coat and the skirt. I saw the laddered run, the flesh of Peggy's thin and dark-haired calf pressing through between each rung. The nail of the finger Peggine ran over its length was bitten down to nothing, but the movement of her hand along the tear was gentle and conciliatory, a kind of sympathy for her own flesh, which I imitated, brushing my own hand along the unbroken silk of Peggine's stocking and then over the torn threads of the run. "I'm a Don," Peggine said. "That's me. That's what I am." She pulled the leg away. The skirt and the blue coat fell into place again. Across the black hem and up the left side of Peggine's good spring coat, there was a long smudge of soot that I impulsively reached out to brush away. "You've got some dirt," I said. Peggine turned, twisted her chin around, arm and elbow raised, trying to see what she couldn't see because it was behind her. "Where?" she said. "Here." I batted at the dirt until Peggine threw back her head in elaborate frustration, pulling the coat forward, winding it around her like a cloak. "I'll be happy," she said, slapping at her hip, "to stop going to that filthy place," meaning Lower Manhattan, where she worked. She paused, her nose in the air, in mock confidence. "I'll get a boyfriend," she said. She batted her eyelashes and drew out a sly smile. They were great kidders, the Shahabs, and no boyfriends, it seemed, had yet called for Peggine. "I'll get myself married," she said, and then licked all at once the four tall fingers of the gloveless hand and swatted them against the dirty cloth. "Amadon," she said again, which, she explained, was her mother's word for fool. And then she released the skirt of her long coat and, dipping her shoulders, shook herself back into it again. She reminded me of a bird taking a sand bath. "I fell down," she announced. She said it in the same fond and impatient tone she had used to describe the lost glove, the forgotten library book, on the subway. It was the tone a mother might use, speaking about a favorite, unruly child. Peggine blew some exasperated air through her pooched-out lower lip. "I don't know what the blazes makes me fall," she said impatiently. "I do it all the time." She suddenly squinted, and the flush just under her downy skin rose to a deep maroon. She lowered her face to mine. "Don't you dare tell my mother," she said. I was 7 years old. I spoke mostly to my parents, to my brother Gabe, to my teachers when I had to. I gave some whispered response to Father Quinn or to Mr. Lee at the candy store when my mother poked me in the ribs. I could not imagine having a conversation with Mrs. Shahab, who was red-haired and very tall. Still, I promised I would say nothing. Peggine shook herself again, standing back and lifting her shoulders inside the pale blue coat. "But there's always someone nice," she said, her voice suddenly gone sing-song. "Someone always helps me up." She struck another pose, coy and haughty as before, her chin in the air. She touched the feather in her hat. "Today a very handsome man gave me his hand. He asked if I was all right. A real Prince Charming." She smiled again and looked around. Just a few doors down, the older boys were playing stickball in the street. There was a knot of younger ones on the sidewalk, watching. Bill Corrigan was in his chair just behind them. Peggine leaned forward once more. "Tomorrow," she said, breathlessly, whispering now, "I'm going to look for him again. If I see him, I'm going to get real close." She leaned down, her hand on the banister above my head. "I'm going to pretend to fall, see? Right next to him. And he'll catch me and say, 'Is it you again?'" All human eyes are beautiful, but Peggine's were very black and heavily lashed and gorgeous now with the sparkle of her joke or her plan or perhaps her vision of some impossible future. She straightened up. "We'll see what happens then," she said, sly and confident, her thick eyebrows raised. She swung her purse slowly, turned to move on. "That will be something to see," she said. At her own house, Pagin didn't use the basement door as usual. She climbed the stone steps, taking them one at a time like a small child. At the top, she paused again to swat at the back of her coat, only touching the dirt with her wrist. It was early evening, spring. I could see Pagin's reflection in the oval glass of the outer door, or at least the blue heart of the reflection, which was both the reflection of her good spring coat and the evening light on her flushed face. Pagin pulled open the door, and the thin image in the glass shuddered like a flame. I turned back to the vigil I was keeping on the stone steps, vigil for my father, who had not yet come up from the subway. So that's the opening of chapter one. The chapter goes on to bring us inside of Marie's house in this brownstone in Brooklyn. In the early part of the 20th century, and we meet her mother and father, and we also meet Gabe, her older brother, her parents' pride and joy, you know, the dream of every Irish immigrant family, the older, handsome son, Kennedy-esque, let us say, who's bound for the priesthood. It doesn't get any better than that, and also recites poetry at the dinner table. So we meet them. The day goes on, and this is the beginning of chapter two. In the morning, the ambulance at the curb gave up a hot breath. Children had gathered, women with coats over their shoulders, men in shirt sleeves. Across the street, curtains were drawn aside. There were faces at windows, one of them ghoulish with shaving cream. First, a murmur among the crowd, women with their fingers to their lips or their hands to their hearts, men conferring softly. Then, as the minutes ticked by, the revving excitement, the pleasure of something happening that would distinguish the ordinary day, the thrill of the disrupted routine, of a dull breakfast left on the table, of school books still at the door, an excitement that sounded first in the children's voices, a sudden laugh, a loud cry, but then infected the grown-ups as well, a sneeze and a cheery God bless, another trill of laughter, as if we had forgotten for a minute that some kind of crisis, some crisis at the Shahab's, had gathered us all here on the damp sidewalk at 7 a.m. And then the ambulance man backing through the basement door, and then the suddenly arrested sound of human chatter gave way at once to the collective intake of breath when those assembled on the sidewalk saw that the stretcher contained a body covered from toe to head, only a slip of Pagin's sloppy hair showing beneath. From the open door behind the second ambulance man, Mrs. Shahab's cry was a spiraling wail. Most of the women and many of the men in the street blessed themselves. My mother put a rough hand to my shoulder and then pulled my face into her apron, which was still a little damp from last night's washing up. All instinct, I shut my eyes and wrapped my arms around my mother's waist, gripping the apron, the rough wool of her skirt, nestling into that familiar darkness and feeling the sudden warmth of my brother's two hands as he pressed them against my ears, trying to spare me the sound of the women's prayers and exclamations, of Mrs. Shahab's lament, of the slam and the slam again of the ambulance's broad doors. All of which, nevertheless, I heard. It was the next evening that we walked in solemn stillness up the steps of the Shahab's house and into the crowded living room. It was painful, the way my mother gripped my hand as we made our way through that forest of adults, all red knuckles for me, and wedding bands, and the hems of jackets, until the figures suddenly parted, and there before the glass of the bay window was the gleaming box and Pagin in its satin bed. She wore her graduation dress, and her red confirmation rosary was threaded through her still fingers. There was a single taper beside Pagin's head, its light reflected in the black window in such a way that for a moment I believed her thin and waxy nose now bore its own flame. I felt a pair of large hands slip themselves under my arms, warm and strong, and then I was aloft. The light grew brighter and the darkness fell away. I clutched the hard edge of the box, resisting even as I gave in, put my face to the moon-colored brightness of Peggy's cheeks, kissed her, and then saw my own white face briefly reflected in the dark glass of the bay window as I was returned once more to the pooled shadows of the floor. At home, my mother unpinned her hat and my father returned his fedora and his topcoat to the closet. Mrs. Shahab, they were saying, had noticed the dirt on Peggy's coat and the tears in her sleeves, circles of soot on the knees of her good stockings well before yesterday's last tumble down the basement stair. Peggy had always been a clumsy girl, they said, although Fagin, the undertaker, suspected something more than the fall had killed her. Some burden in the brain, he said. My mother turned back the good tablecloth, and my brother Gabe brought out his books. On this evening, to make up for the time lost on our visit to Peggy, we had our tea quietly as he studied among us, the only sound in the room the ringing of my father's cup against the saucer, which I imitated with the clanging of my own. The visit to the Shahabs had deprived us of our evening walk to the speakeasy as well. And then my brother closed the thick book before him and reached for another from the pile beside his chair, this one worn and leather-bound with thin pages. He turned them, and then, with his hands tucked under his thighs, bent over the book to read. I saw my parents look to him, to the top of his bowed head. It seemed to me they were watching him slyly, as if, were he to raise his head again, their eyes would dart away. He began to read out loud. He did not read in the same clear way he recited his poems, but softly, sitting hunched over the table, the words breaking here and there under the burden of his new, thickening voice. "Are not two sparrows sold for a small coin," he read, "yet not one of them falls to the ground without your father's knowledge. Even all the hairs of your head are counted, so do not be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." My mother's head was bowed. My father's two hands remained folded together over the china cup, arrested in that surreptitious moment of their steadying each other against the trembling that his evening constitutional to the speakeasy usually kept at bay. Out on the street, a truck carrying bottles rattled by. One happy voice shouted to another. Into the silence that followed, I said, "Amadon." I said it as Peggy had said it, ruefully, shaking my head as if speaking fondly of a troublesome child. I said it with my chin just above my own china cup and its dregs of melting sugar, with my eyes veering away from my brother's startled face and down into that ivory light, and then for good measure I said it again into the teacup itself. "Amadon." The pretty room tilted then. Folded white tablecloth and black polished wood in the light of the simple chandelier, as my mother, with an iron grip on my upper arm, swung me out of my chair and into the tiled bathroom, where the cup was filled beneath the silver stream of warm water and the soap dipped into it once, then twice. "Again," my mother said, as I tasted the bitter water and, leaning over the porcelain, spit it out into the sink. In the dining room, my brother, the scholar, was asking my father what it meant, "Amadon." My father said, "A fool. It means someone's a fool." Even with the water running, the cup of soapy water at my lips, I could hear my father's shout of laughter when my brother asked him, "Who is?" They called me our little pagan after that, whenever their pride in my brother's saintliness was in need of some deflating, self-deflating, as was their way, when the priest from St. Francis came to say there was clearly a vocation, when the letter from the seminary arrived. "We're not so enamored of the priesthood as some," my mother said, washing the dishes after the priest had come for tea, blushing with pride, but also holding her lips in such a way that made it clear she was not going to go overboard, as she would have put it, with her delight in Gabe's success. There were just as many men in rectory, she said, who were vain or lazy or stupid as there were in the general population. One bishop, my father joked, his hand to the top of my head, and one little pagan. We've run the gamut in just these two. Thank you. Thank you. So I have to tell you a funny story. I was reading, a week ago, a month ago, someplace in Brooklyn. And afterwards, and I didn't read that section, but afterwards a woman came up to me and she said, "I started reading your novel." She said, "My father was Lebanese and my mother was Irish and I grew up in Brooklyn and I read those first pages and I thought, finally, a book about me. Finally, a book with a character that's just about me." And then she died. You killed her off in the second chapter. I promised her a prequel that I would write. The next book will be Peggy's first 17 years before she falls down the stairs. So if anyone has a similar background, I apologize. I'm happy to begin a discussion or take questions or comments or whatever you're curious about or not.
Well, I'll start.
Thank you.
I read the book.
Thank you.
And I've read all of your books, and I have to tell you, this one to me is a masterpiece. From the moment I started reading it, I could not put it down. I feel like I want to have it and read it once a year and pass it on to my friends. It's absolutely beautiful. And the one question I have is, how long did it take to write it? Because that little tiny book feels like an epic.
Well, thank you very much. See, now you've put me in a very awkward position because this is being podcast, I'm supposed to repeat the question. So I'm going to repeat. This is a masterpiece, and I mean, I'm just saying, you know. But the real question is, how long did it take to get this composed? And it has been 7 years since after this, my last novel. But it's always hard for me to judge just how long anything takes. Number one, I always work on two novels at the same time, which is a very bad thing to do. And any aspiring novelist should not take that as a piece of writing advice. It's just a habit that I fell into from my second novel on. It's just, I don't know why I do it. It's a fail-safe. It's a way to procrastinate, not be writing the one that my editor thinks I'm writing, but sneaking off and writing the other one and getting all the joy of procrastinating but still getting something done. So because of that, it's hard to say. But certainly I have been working on this novel. I handed it to my editor in December, and I began working on it even before my last novel came out. So certainly 7 years with it in work, in composing stages.
To get those sentences so tight, it's just, you paint a picture that is just absolutely beautiful.
Thank you very much. You know, it's a funny thing, and just as a craft for people who are interested in such things. I mean, I knew from the very beginning that I wanted to give this novel entirely to this character, and I was aware at some risk of doing that. Actually, I was scared to death to do that. I mean, I say that with cool now, with now that it's over, you know, cool detachment. Yes, I was aware of some risk. No, I was scared to death, and I was beating myself up all the time and not sleeping and doing all those writerly things of pacing and yelling at my kids and doing things like, because I was aware that it is a simple life. It is an ordinary or recognizable life. And I wasn't after a big plot line. And I also understood this was a character who did not have much voice even in her own life. To be first-generation immigrant in a city, coming of age in the 30s and the 40s, at a time when, you know, we laugh about it now, men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses, but that was not a joke. I mean, that was the era and the atmosphere. And marriage or the convent were pretty much, or old maid, you know, if you got to be 28 and you hadn't had six kids yet, you know, that pretty much what the future held, and also not much listened to her place. So understanding that I had a character who didn't have a big life and didn't have a big voice and was not much heard from in her own life and is not much heard from in fiction, and putting all those things together. I mean, I have notes in my notebooks, you know, those suffering things about, you know, all the men around her have such interesting stories. Maybe I better give them a couple of chapters, just for the guys out there, but so the struggle to keep focused on her voice and understand that she, as we all do, had a vibrant inner life. And her way of seeing the world would change over time and over the course of her life and make that the subject of the novel. But I have never done this before, and in all my years of teaching, when students would come into me and say, oh, I can't finish this short story, or I can't go any further because I can't decide if it should be a close third person or first person, and I just can't make up my mind. And I would always say, oh, for God's sake, it's not that different. You know, just make a decision and write your story. And I wrote most of someone in the third person, and something just wasn't. Actually, I had an excerpt published in the third person, and something about it just wasn't settling with me. And then I realized I was taking away her voice. I was going along with everyone else, even by just that slight shift of she walked rather than I walked. I was, you know, I was, as the author, I was just not giving her the full credit of her voice. And that took a long time for me to understand. So thank you. Yes. Sure. Talk about the whole process of doing research to authenticate the era. You know, research to me is the siren song. I love doing research, and now with the internet, it's so easy, and you can spend weeks, months researching and reading all these interesting things, and at the end of those weeks and months, you haven't written a sentence that's going to end up in the book, and you found out a lot of really neat information that you might end up surgically inserting into the book, not because it belongs there, but just because you found this really interesting information. So I tend to write most of the novel first, get the sound, get the voice, get the sound of the prose, get the characters, let the characters appear on the page and become who they are through the writing. And if there are places where I'm just doing my best guess for historical accuracy, I will just plug it in. And then when the novel has its own integrity, when I understand more fully what it's about and the characters have come to life, then I go back and do research. So I do it backwards. That's another bad piece of advice. Don't write two novels at the same time and do your research first. But I don't do it that way. I'm a contrarian. And I just find, you know, sometimes things that you intuit, it's amazing. You find out you were, you know, in some way you were accurate. But especially, you know, I never think of myself as writing historical fiction. But the older I get, I realize the stuff that I thought was contemporary at the beginning of my career has now become historical fiction. But I don't want to get caught up in the era. I'm not writing for the era. For me, it's character, and it's how the character perceives the world around her and what she sees. So, there are plenty of things you have to plug in, and historical context needs to be clear, because believe me, you will hear from readers if it's not. It's one of the favorite things for readers to do. But for me, character and the interior life is primary. And I suppose that maybe distinguishes what a real, you know, a historical novelist who's really out to capture an era first and foremost, and the characters merely illustrate the era. For me, it's turned around. It's the character first, and in some ways, the era is secondary and only arbitrary. I'm not after defining the time and place, except for the way the character saw it. Yes.
Alice, you said something a minute ago. You said get the voice. I think getting the voice can be really difficult.
Yes. Yes, the whole notion of getting the voice. I think in some ways it's the hardest thing to do. One of the Eudora Welty says this wonderful thing, and I wish I could tell you exactly where she said it. And one of these days when I'm doing research, I will look it up. but she made this point about you sort of know when you're hitting your sweet spot when you're writing, when you can hear the sound of the next sentence before you know what the words are. You know, so voice and rhythm, you know, to me, are very closely aligned. In some ways, you know, voice on one level is first person, third person, omniscient, who's speaking into the reader's ear. But then it's also diction and sentence length and just the rhythm of the prose. And sometimes that just takes a lot of stabs, you know, and a lot of writing and rewriting. I think that's the place, and I often talk to my students about this, that's the place where, as the writer, you have to struggle the most to get yourself out of the way, is voice. You know, again, to give yourself, as happened in my experience with this novel, to put yourself at the service of the narrator or the character, rather than to try to manipulate the character to say something you want the character to say or to speak in a certain way.
Do
I ever write nonfiction? On occasion. It's not my favorite form. Because the impulse to lie is just so strong, you know, and the real world is so poorly done, and fiction can be so superior, you know. Fiction makes sense. Real life doesn't, you know. There's a reason for being for every detail. At least you hope that's the goal. Every detail you choose when you're writing a novel or a short story is purposeful. Because you could do it. You're making this stuff up. You can say anything. Not so in life, you know. There aren't that many levels of meaning. So I occasionally write. I would never write a memoir, and I occasionally write sort of personal essay things. But I always have to stay my hands. Like, well, he didn't really say that, but it would have been so much more interesting if he had. And I think, oh no, you know, once you say this is true, you have to stick with it. Yes.
I don't think you're wrong doing research after you do the writing, because I think sometimes when a writer does too much research ahead of time, they lose the voice because they're trying to work in too much. Sometimes when you read a novel and you can tell they're just trying to put way too much in there, and you want to say to them, why don't you just take some of that out and just tell us in a nice, plain way. We'll fill in some of those details if you really want to.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It's almost like going to a baseball game sometime and there's a post, you know. I wish that post wasn't, you know, just let that part go.
Yeah, exactly.
I know you have to do some research to make sure that when you know, somebody doesn't write to you and say, wow, they never did that in the 1990s.
Right, yeah. And I think... Yeah, and I think that whole notion of researching after and not being caught up in the research, again, speaks to that whole getting out of your own way. You know, for the writer to get out of the way, get your ego out of the way, get your worries about who's going to publish this and what are they going to say after it's published, and am I going to make any money and all that. Self-consciousness, yeah. Madeleine L'Engle talked about writing fiction as being equivalent to prayer. You know, that, and it is a kind of, and I think that goes back to voice too. There is a sense of incantation in working with words, and then the images follow, and that whole notion of having too much information and being too much in control. The late Seamus Heaney, who had a loss to literature, said in a beautiful poem called The Gravel Walk, but also in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, he said to young poets, we must teach ourselves to walk on air against our better judgment. And it's that notion of walking on air, of sitting down and writing and not knowing exactly what your story is or where you're going to go, rather than delivering, you know, on a trolley, this whole set of information that you've looked up and that you've got to try to surgically insert. Right, right. And the other thing that you bring up that I really appreciate, as a reader, I like to read writers who are acknowledging that we're in this together.
Right.
You know, that it's reader and writer. And so, yeah, that spoon feeding or the writer, it's all about the writer, and, you know, the writer's doing cartwheels and setting off fireworks, and I'm not having any fun. I'm the reader, and I'm sitting in the dark. But that whole sense of the reader and writer together, the marvelous thing about reading, and for my taste, it's reading fiction, but anything, is that intimacy. It's sort of lending the voice with which we speak to ourselves. You know, we can call it thought, or you can call it stream of kind, but we all have it, you know, and sometimes it's just, oh, got to get the milk, oh, I need gas, you know. But also it's what's life all about, and why am I so sad, or why did that make me happy? But that voice is the voice that a reader lends to a writer. And that is a great act of generosity. That is, because when you're reading, you're not thinking, I got to get the milk. You're simply giving that your thought, your interior voice that no one else can fully share. You can say, this is what I'm thinking. But you all know, as soon as someone says, you know what I'm thinking, you know they're not telling you what they're thinking. You know? But a reader lends that. Totally gives that over to a writer, and the writer takes his or her own voice and allows the reader to borrow it. And I think it still amazes me, and I still love it. That's why I still love to read. You know, it's a delightful, intimate communion between two minds, not three, not four, just between two minds. And I appreciate the readers, the writers who say to me as a reader, I know you have patience. I know you'll notice this. I know you'll remember this. Or maybe even you'll give me the great good grace of when you get to the end, reading it again. So all those things. And so I am very grateful to all of you readers. Thank you so much for lending your most private voice to, or sharing my voice with your most private voice. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.